From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caritti, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, September 13th, 2016. And on this day, Maine utility regulators propose to change how solar power producers are compensated for energy they supply to the grid. Environmental activists stage a sit-in at the PUC to protest a decision to have electricity consumers finance a potential expansion of natural gas capacity. And the increasingly punitive approach to juveniles who commit crimes isn't working, a leading psychologist says, and it's because of the way the teen brain is wired. Those stories and more after this. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caritti. Maine regulators are proposing changes to the way the state's solar power producers are compensated for excess energy they put on the grid. And it's more generous than what Governor Paul LePage has put forth. Fred Bever has more.
The draft proposal from the Maine Public Utilities Commission would give existing solar power producers a 15-year grandfather period during which they can continue to earn the same rates for excess power that they put on the grid. That's much longer than the 3 years that Governor Paul LePage has proposed. But the commission is also calling for major changes in how new solar providers are paid. For solar installations that go in after a new rule is adopted, one portion of the excess power credits they could receive related to poles and wires charges on electricity bills would be phased out over 10 years. Commission Chairman Mark Vinoy says that's because solar tech's getting cheaper, and future solar producers shouldn't shift their share of poles and wires costs onto the rest of the grid's users.
The basic changes in the rule seek to equitably compensate distributed generation owners for their excess energy while tailoring the program to the cost declines that are occurring and are projected to occur.
A written draft of the proposal has yet to be issued. Vinoy left open the question of exactly how new solar producers should be paid for the electrons they put on the grid. He suggests that with the advent of smart meter technology, which can track electricity flows in nearly real time, solar producers might want payments linked directly to wholesale energy markets. Vinoy cites a massive spike in spot market electricity prices last month that was linked to an outage at a nuclear plant in Connecticut. Solar producers, he says, could take advantage of those moments.
It would be very possible for a producer during that period to be well on their way to paying for their entire installation. When you have excursions in price like that, there's a lot of money to be made.
But some stakeholders don't like the idea of moving away from the old system of credits known as net metering.
All of this shouldn't be happening. The Public Utilities Commission didn't need to propose changes to net metering. They were under no obligation to do so.
Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine says the proposal could cut by half the price solar producers receive for excess energy. And he says an independent analysis commissioned by the PUC itself concluded that local solar generation benefits all Maine electricity users by reducing demand on the grid.
So slowing down on solar is not the direction that Maine should go in when it's already in last place in the Northeast.
The proposal also includes new consumer protections, provisions for group solar projects, and a bigger goal for the amount of solar power Maine should produce. It will now be reviewed by the stakeholders from all sides of the issue before the commission makes a final decision. And then it's widely expected that the next legislature will take up the debate again. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Meanwhile, a group of about 25 environmental activists staged a sit-in at the Public Utilities Commission today. They were protesting the agency's decision to have electricity ratepayers finance a potential expansion of natural gas capacity. Steve Missler has that story.
The protest by the group Maine Students for Climate Justice was meant to get the attention of the three commissioners of the PUC. It was specifically designed to oppose the commission's decision in July to have ratepayers underwrite natural gas pipeline expansion.
Frack gas has got to go, hey, hey, ho, ho. Frack gas has got to go, hey, hey, ho, ho.
The group had hoped to confront the commissioners in the lobby, but they were informed that only Commissioner Bruce Williamson was in the building, and he would be in meetings until into the evening. Chloe Maxman, a 24-year-old student from Nobleboro, said the group would wait.
We are staying here for 96 minutes, so it's 1 minute for each dollar that the PUC wants us to pay to fund fracked gas infrastructure.
The PUC's decision to greenlight the ratepayer finance expansion immediately drew the ire of environmental groups, which are already working to challenge it in court. They argue that ratepayers should not have to pay for the expansion, especially for fracked natural gas. Alyssa Thompson, a senior at Monmouth Academy, said if the state is going to make ratepayers invest in energy infrastructure, it should be for renewable energy projects. Opponents have also cited a PUC staff report advising against the expansion because Maine ratepayers are unlikely to benefit. The expansion, pegged at roughly $1.5 billion, is in doubt, in part because of a Massachusetts court decision that ruled against ratepayers having to subsidize private gas projects. Spectra Energy has said it hopes to move forward with the expansion. The activists said the sit-in was also a show of solidarity for the Standing Rock Sioux, the tribe protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
And Governor LePage today was at an Augusta news conference held to announce the revival of a program launched in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Officials with the Maine Department of Public Safety, police departments, and the National Guard joined the governor, who said the program is being revived to encourage residents to be alert to any suspicious behavior and to report it to police.
The goals for this program is to have the ears and eyes of Maine citizens looking out for each other. If we see danger, report it.
Reports to police are sent to the Maine Information and Analysis Center, or Fusion Center, which assesses their validity and passes on any information suggesting a credible terrorist threat. Meanwhile, the U.S. Census has released data on health insurance coverage, indicating that a higher percentage of Maine residents have health insurance coverage than the nation as a whole. The Census has started to report data from its population survey for 2015, and the good news is that between 2014 and 2015, the percentage of Maine residents without health insurance coverage dropped from 10.1% to 8.4%. The rate of uninsured for the nation as a whole is 9.1%.
We are seeing improvements. All the states are seeing improvements, but our improvement has just been sort of much slower than many of the other states. And so we're actually creeping closer to the average.
That's James Mayall, a policy analyst with the Maine Center for Economic Policy. Mayall says relative to other states, Maine is losing ground when it comes to health insurance. He says more Mainers could be covered if the state took advantage of federal law and expanded Medicaid coverage to more poor residents. Coming up, how the development of the teenage brain might be dooming the nation's increasingly punitive approach to juveniles who commit crimes. Down in Washington, the Senate Armed Services Committee is holding hearings on how to protect against cyber attacks on the military and on crucial civilian infrastructure, such as telecommunications and the electric grid. Mal Leary has more.
Senator Angus King serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee and is very worried about the vulnerability of the United States to cyber attacks. He says as the world's most wired nation, we're the most vulnerable to internet-based attacks. King says the military is starting to respond to the threat, but important civilian systems, like the power grid, have been slow to establish defenses against internet attacks by hackers. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And you might have heard the news yesterday about two teenage boys who allegedly stole a front-end loader parked near the Maine Turnpike in West Gardner and led police on a low-speed chase for several miles. During their drive, some of it the wrong way down the highway, the two boys did substantial damage to property and hit two cars, one of them a police cruiser. No one was injured, but on hearing the news, you might have wondered, what on earth were they thinking? While that's still not clear, and police are still investigating the incident, but the fact that the drivers of the front-end loader were teenage boys might help answer the question. Psychologist Elizabeth Kaufman researches the brain development of teenagers and young adults, many of whom commit much more serious crimes. Her work has played a key role in recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions that abolished both the death penalty and life without parole for juvenile offenders. Kaufman says the increasingly punitive approach that's been taken toward juvenile crime over the last several decades doesn't lead to better outcomes, in part because older juveniles' brains still aren't fully developed, as she explains in a conversation with Nora Flaherty.
The frontal lobe of the brain, or the prefrontal cortex, which is the area right behind your forehead, that part of the brain continues to develop well into age 25. And now, why does that matter? Because that part of the brain is like the CEO of the company. It runs the business. And so it's responsible for impulse control, thinking long term, resisting those peer influences. And if that part of the brain isn't fully developed till age 25, well, then that helps us understand why that disconnect occurs. The part of the brain that regulates it isn't in place.
You've done work on outcomes for juveniles who commit crimes and go into the system. And what have you found about people continuing to commit crimes?
We have done a series of different studies. One study was with youth between the ages of 14 and 17 when we first started following them. And we followed them for over 7 years to look at what gets kids out of crime. Can we predict who's going to stop? So we followed these kids for 7 years, and they started with very serious crimes, robbery, aggravated assault. Some of them had even committed murder. Do any of these kids stop? And the short answer to the question is yes, they do stop. In fact, the majority do. Only 9% of the kids persisted at a high level of offending. The rest of the kids, by the time they reached in their mid-20s, stopped offending. And this is really important because it speaks to the offense versus the offender. A lot of times people confuse the two. Kids don't specialize in crime. Just because they've committed a serious crime when they were 14 doesn't mean that's who they are. In fact, the main difference between adult crime and adolescent crime is adults tend to specialize, kids don't. Most kids grow up and grow out of crime. And in fact, that's what we see. If you look at their normal developmental course, the kids who grew out of crime developed impulse control, the ability to think long term. The kids who persisted, the ones who didn't stop offending, those kids never developed that self-regulation, that self-control. And this is important because ultimately, when we're making policies and practices, if we know that most kids change and most kids, even kids who commit serious crimes, stop, then maybe we need to design policies and practices that reflect what we know from the science.
Over the last few decades, approaches to dealing with juvenile crime have become more punitive and more entrenched in the criminal justice system. Could you just talk a little bit about why that is?
The juvenile court wasn't actually created till 1899. And so this is a system that's really developed over the years. Before that, we used to treat kids just like adults all the time until we learned kids were different. This pendulum has swung back and forth over the years based on what people believe about juvenile crime. And in 1899, people knew kids were different from adults and developed a completely different system so that they would be treated differently. As things changed and moved, we've actually moved much more to a punitive system. And it was in the 80s, this notion of the super predator is coming and the kids are dangerous. And so we became much more punitive with our youth. And in fact, one of the things that we're starting to work on is, look, maybe these policies aren't working and maybe we do need to change how we treat kids. But change is slow. But I do think we are making progress and that every state is starting to take a look at itself and say, what is the right approach? Because if we know kids are different, if we know kids can change, then how can we treat them to better get the better outcome in the long run? Because at the end of the day, incarcerating someone is an exorbitantly expensive operation. You get your best bang for your buck by keeping kids in community programs, keeping them out of jail systems. That said, you still have public safety to take into account. So you have to find that balance of when you need to use those dollars and what the best resources are. Just getting tough on crime doesn't actually solve the problem and, in fact, can exacerbate it.
Dr. Elizabeth Kaufman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that was Nora Flaherty talking with Elizabeth Kaufman, a professor of psychology and social behavior, education, and law at the University of California at Irvine. She spoke this morning at the University of Southern Maine on brain science and vulnerable older youth. And if you were on the Maine Turnpike today, you might have seen an electronic message board alerting you to the disappearance of a teenager from Old Town. The Maine Department of Transportation and the Maine Turnpike Authority activated the message boards to help police find 15-year-old Natalie Cody. Cody went missing Monday after her stepfather picked her up from school, and officials say she could possibly be in danger. Old Town Police Captain Lee Miller says Natalie left willingly with 43-year-old Christopher Julian.
We've seen a video at a store in Bangor that shows them walking together, shows her pushing the cart.
Police issued an arrest warrant for Julian on a criminal restraint charge. Police believe the two are in a 2004 black Mercury Mountaineer with a Maine license plate. The stepfather is described as a white man with a shaved head, brown goatee, and several tattoos, who may be wearing an aircast boot. And finally, here is meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
Following two lovely days, we had the opportunity to receive some badly needed rain, yet not nearly enough. Clouds will thicken over northern Maine with showers by dawn. Western Maine, clear skies early, overcast by daybreak. Generally cloudless remainder and quite balmy, 55 to 60. A broad swath of showers will accompany cold front that will settle through Maine tomorrow. Showers ending in the afternoon north, but not even arriving until early afternoon far south, where a few robust thunderstorms may precede the fun. A breezy day, cool north, mid-60s, to toasty south, low 80s. Thursday will sense a light dose of fall. Skies will be partly cloudy over northern and western Maine, with nearly full sunshine for the remainder of the state, 60 north, 71 south. Temperatures recover smartly Friday. Abundant sunshine statewide. Upper 60s to mid-70s north to south. Saturday, over northern and western Maine, clouds will thicken with showers in the St. John Valley only late. But the rest of the state quite nice, with bright sun fading during the afternoon. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, September 13th, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Fred Bever, Steve Missler, Mal Leary, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.